Good morning. Oh, man, tired. I know, it's early. Thanks for coming out. My name's Tony Sager from the National Security Agency. Yes, I'm a Fed. I look like a Fed. I talk like a Fed, dress like a Fed. It's a long career for me in federal service. I'm proud of it. Thanks for coming out to see me today. I know you got a lot of options out there. You could be waiting in line for your badge. You could be at one of the other talks. I also know it's kind of early for some of you guys, so I doubly appreciate you coming out to see me talk today. I just came from speaking at Black Hat. Did anybody catch my address over there, the keynote address? This is all fresh and new except for a couple of folks. So I'll try not to bore you with something I said before. There'll be some repeats. I'll talk a little bit more about some other things I think is more appropriate for this audience. But it's a real honor to come out here. Nico Sell asked if I would first come to Black Hat and then speak here at DEF CON also. As you know, the NSA guys don't get out that much. I get out more than most to talk to people about the business that we're in. My goal today is I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we call the information assurance business at NSA, this business of dealing with the world of vulnerability and network security, and there's all kinds of names that have developed over the years with it. It's a really challenging, important national problem. You guys are part of this community that deals with this kind of stuff. And I think that my goal is I'm going to tell you a little bit about our mission, what we do, the kind of business that I personally have been in for a long time. I hope that you'll be, number one, surprised by how open NSA has been in terms of the work that we do and the stuff that we give out into the community. And I also hope that by the end of this you'll figure out that we might have a lot more in common than we do different, so aside from the way I dress, of course. Anyway, so just for a little bit of context, I really am a lifer at this sort of business. So I started at NSA, it'll be 30 years next month. And I actually have a little over 30 years of federal service. I spent a couple years in summer jobs for the Department of the Army as a mathematician, kind of junior guy, mailroom clerk, and all that kind of beginner sort of work that you do when you're starting out. And then wound up at NSA starting in September of 77 after I got out of college as a young mathematician. And little did I know what I was getting into, very exciting career, a lot of great opportunities. And the context is kind of this. In fact, the world is so different now than when I started. In fact, the world I started in, a lot of you were not even alive at that point. The world of technology was entirely different, right? When I started, my kids love this, I took the only computer course that my college offered. I mean, that was it. There was one Fortran programming course, linear programming for math geeks, and I thought, man, who wants to do this? You know, punching cards. I know that sounds like a dinosaur stuff, right? Punching cards, carrying card decks, trying to talk the guy at the computer center into giving me more than two runs a day. Screwing up the JCL cards all the time. You know, that was a really different kind of business. And I thought, who would ever want to get involved with this? And then when I got into professional life at NSA, it was a lot different. But the world of security and secrecy was so much different then. So the way I was offered the job at NSA, I got a phone call. My summer job at Aberdeen Proving Ground was running out. It's about middle of September, and you know, I had applied a year before. That's how long it takes to wind up working at a place like mine. Got a call. If you can report in 2 weeks, you got a job. Great, because my job ran out in about 2 weeks. I said, oh, great, what is this job? He said, well, communications security intern. I said, great, what is that? And he said, well, go to the Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, back when they were paper, big books, you know, whole shelf. Look up the article on cryptography. And it was written by a guy, again, I think this predates most of you, a guy named David Kahn. We'd written a book called The Code Breakers back then, and it was a really the first really large-scale public discussion of cryptography and the mathematics behind it and the role of the NSA in places like that. So, you know, historical figure had written this article for the Encyclopedia Britannica. So that's literally all I knew going in. And so 30 years now close to at NSA. So in my entire career at NSA, and what I do at NSA is not what you think of when you think of NSA. Okay. I spent my whole 30 years in the defensive business at NSA, which is a bit unusual for a career like mine. In the defensive business, and many of you probably didn't even know NSA had a defensive mission, I've always been one of the vulnerability finders, the people whose job it is to figure out what's wrong with U.S. information systems, preferably before somebody else does. So my early days were as a mathematician, doing analysis of systems and the mathematics. You know, when I was a mathematician, right, then mathematics is obviously the most important thing going in security. And then when I switched to computer science, obviously computer science is much more important than the mathematics. But in the early 80s, I switched my focus to computer science, the kind of field that most of you folks are involved in. And I know this is another dinosaur moment for you guys. When I realized the government would buy me my very own Apple II to have on my desk, and that was the coolest thing I could imagine. That was a $2,500 computer. 48K RAM, right? 16K you could add with a language card, the program Pascal. I see some gray beards out here who were there with me. That was a hot machine back then. That was pretty cool. And learning the program and ready for the 6502 assembly language. And, you know, very simple 8-bit processor, but really a fun way to learn about computing. And I thought, this is pretty fun stuff. I'm really interested. So that was triggered the majority of my career, what I call looking at other people's software for a living, and doing analysis of systems and kind of the skills that many of you have out here. But the business that I'm in is really different than it was back then. So back then, the output of our business, okay, was things. And these phrases ring for you, key generators and link encryptors and voice scramblers and things like that, right? That was the business that NSA was in, protecting information, and we could identify the links that were at risk. We could think up the mathematics to protect it, and we could build it, and we could control the whole thing. We could decide how those circuits should be laid out, down to the gate and transistor. We could, if there was software in it, which was not true when I started, we could examine, own, test, and validate, and protect forever every line of code that was going to drive that device. And the kind of analysis that I did was the stuff we did in the back room, right? We built stuff, but we did analysis so that we built the right stuff. We didn't make mistakes in that part. That's a different model. The government was a monopoly provider of security services, right? Only the government really understood, the government cared, the government could control. And in that world, which is so different than the world we live in today, we could design away the risk. We could decide and control for the lifetime of that equipment or that system. That's a different world than we live in today, right? We're all connected, we're talking to everybody, technology is rolling over faster than we can understand it. And we're connected to everybody. And the thought that we'd be sharing the same network, friend and foe, my kids, everybody in this room, it was not even in our consciousness at that time. So a really different world. And so the role of the government, I think, really changes in that kind of scenario, in the world that we live in today. And some parts of the government have figured that out, and some parts have not figured that out. But some of the things that I've concluded, and the way we talk about these things strategically in my part of the National Security Agency, is, you know, it's less about the government stuff that we build, more about the commercial technology that we all live in, right? And some of you are involved in both building that and analysis of that. But when it comes down to it, that's what's touching all our information, moving it around, storing it, and really protecting it the other day. And also, we can no longer confine security to individual things protecting individual links. Information has to be protected wherever it is. It's a really different kind of problem. And when the government has a monopoly, that's a much different business than where we are today. So today, and I'll talk a lot about this later, I view this as a business of influence, not as a business of control. Right? The government doesn't have the authority or the money or the ability to control all angles of this. Security is just too pervasive and too widespread. So you have to, and you cannot separate out the assurance or the security problem from all the things around information technology and all the things around the way people conduct information or deal with information or, in my world, conduct military operations. So there are lots of stakeholders in this business, and I use these five categories I'll talk about in a moment. So it's not about do we have the right technical solution that we built. It's about all these other things, you know, the policies that govern us and the compliance things that we have to deal with and the way we purchase our IT and the way we configure it and we operate it and run it and the way we report about problems and share them. That's a dramatically different problem for the government to deal with today than we've had for the last 10 years. And so building, again, it's less about the government products, more about a knowledge business. So the stuff that folks like me used to do in the back room has become the output of the mission now at NSA. You know, an understanding of the vulnerabilities in technology is really more important than taking apart any one thing and then building the best possible thing. Because, frankly, the way the government builds things, you know, we have lots of restrictions on funding and oversight and all this. We cannot build things fast enough, nimble enough, responsive enough to the marketplace. It's just not possible anymore. Not everyone understands that in the government, but it's just not possible anymore. So you have to think of this as how do we get in the evolutionary path for all this technology to help people improve things as we go. And then the last is about the conclusion that I would draw about the way our mission has changed and the way we're going is about this dynamic operational focus. So that is, in the late 70s, 80s, we could build a thing, put it out there. If we found a flaw later, we could fix it. But it's a different world, right? And now things happen so fast, and it's less about protecting the information for decades from, you know, big monolithic adversaries. It's about protecting information dynamically, constantly. And so if you see the things that my folks do today, we're much more, I'll say, in the fight, supporting war fighters directly in risky parts of the world, helping people with, you know, issues around IT configuration and how do we operate things right now, and new technologies rolled out, a new vulnerability has been found by maybe somebody in this room, what do we do about it? It's a much more dynamic, much more focused business across a wider range of topics than ever before. So it's very challenging, but it's also very exciting because it brings us into this community with folks like you. So, again, I've got 3 decades of experience in this, and you know, the work has a couple decades before me, and so my boss a year ago reorganized some things, created a new group called the Vulnerability Analysis and Operations Group, and asked me to run it. And it's very humbling because it's a really amazing group of people and a great mission at NSA. I often say that I have the best job in the U.S. government in network security. I mean, it just doesn't get any better than this. And what he did was bring together all the vulnerability finders that worked for him, everybody in the defensive mission at NSA whose business it is to find vulnerability for a living. Okay, so that goes back, and some of this work is literally 4 or 5 decades old if you've read any of the later histories of World War II. The cryptanalysis, the mathematics that underlie security, right? That's part of my group. All the way up to the testing of the security of individual products, you know, kind of what's happening, the buzz and the latest vulnerability and the latest piece of IT, all the way out to the field and operational testing, things like red team testing, blue team testing. If any ex-military are out there, ComSec monitoring or JICMA, if that rings a bell, we have that full range of things. Those kinds of skills, those kinds of missions from, again, the most conceptual, most esoteric, out to the most live, current, operational. And we have every skill that can go along with that. You know, I won't give you a wiring diagram, but it's sort of everything you can imagine throwing at this. That's part of my group. So it's very challenging and also very humbling. And also a thing to point out is that, you know, for us, the vulnerability business, we loosely use this term, is a full spectrum business, right? At the national level, as a worldwide problem, this is much more than flaws in IT, you know, the latest bug in a piece of software. That's a really important part of it. But, you know, at the national level, everybody cheats, okay? People will do all kinds of things, and we have people that worry about the security of the physical spaces and the signal environment and the hardware and all these other kinds of problems. So we have a very diverse set of technical people and skills and laboratories and relationships to help us pull that mission off. So a lot of exciting opportunity in that. So, you know, I'm a good bureaucrat. When you start an organization, you have to have a vision statement. I got a vision statement. You can take it for what it's worth, but I'm going to point out a few words for you, just to context, and I think it'll help you understand where I'm coming from. The nation's most capable, influential, and trusted. So those 3 words. Capable, okay, is in part about technical capability. And I think most people would grant NSA a lot of technical capability if you've ever dealt with us before. But capability is also about mission capability. Can you deliver those skills at the right place in the right time to do something useful? That's a really different kind of problem. And I mentioned how dynamic this world is now. And so it's not about, you know, studying, coming up with the best technical answer, the most technically capable. It's about figuring out how to deliver that kind of skill at the right time, the right place. That leads me to influence, I mentioned earlier, about how I see this really as a business of influence now, which means helping people all across the spectrum of stakeholders in this business how to improve. And I'll walk you through an example of that. Again, to give you an example of the way that we've been thinking about this, the way we've changed the mode that the government bureaucracy from NSA operates, and then the role that we play in the community. And then trusted, thank you, no one laughed when the NSA guy said trusted, I really appreciate that, because I don't always get that. But trust is a challenging thing to get a hold of, right? I can't declare trust, you have to earn trust. Trust is about behavior, the way you operate. And in our kind of business, trust is about sort of what you bring to the table, what you deliver, what content you create and bring to part of the community. And I really saw this shifting in the late 90s and early 2000s. You know, it has become, you know, no one in this room probably is impressed if I walk in and say, we're the government, we're here to help you, right? Or we're the government, we're here to organize you. The model is a lot different. There's a lot more openness and connectivity in this community. So people really don't care whether you're a government agency, a multinational corporation, Joe's garage shop, or, you know, somebody working out of the basement. You're capable of creating intellectual property that didn't exist, that's critical to everybody else. Isn't that a really weird, exciting world? And so you have to think of trust as what are you bringing to the table? And people really don't much care about the authority or the oversight or whatever, that they, at least not the world that I live in anymore. So trust is about behavior. So, again, I'm not asking you to trust me. I'll give you examples of what we have done and how we operate. bring ourselves and the content that we create into the community, and you can just decide for yourself. And then actionable information, just a quick sentence on that or so. You know, when I started, you can make a great living just poking holes in other people's stuff. And it's great work if you can get it. But, you know, I tell people, if knowing about vulnerabilities was the solution to the national problem, then we were all out of work 5 or 10 years ago, right? We're awash in vulnerabilities. We find them all the time in every product and every aspect of the way we operate today. The challenge is, can we take that knowledge, put it together in some useful way that's actionable, that is, that changes things about the environment and improves security? And so, again, I hope I'll walk you through an example of how we've done that. So, real quickly, this is kind of my simple management model about thinking of the information assurance business and its pervasiveness. And I mentioned earlier the stakeholders in this business. And so, for my simple purposes, it's useful to divide all the stakeholders around security into 5 bins, okay, and you can see them up here. And why do I do that? Well, number one, because if you think of all the folks and organizations and oversight things that are involved in this, it just makes your head hurt. There's no way to get a handle on it. So you have to simplify the problem a bit, and you have to think about this problem. And the reason you need to think this way and categorize things is that here's a challenge in security. Every one of these categories of stakeholders thinks of this problem differently. You know, how to solve the national problem, and each of them speaks a different language, which is dramatically different. So if you're going to have influence or change behavior, you have to speak to people in their language is the bottom line, right? And you guys are in the practitioner category by and large, I'm sure. That is, you live and breathe and think security. You know, this is your preoccupation or your profession or whatever you bring to the table in this. And most, I know it's a shock to some of you, but most of the world could care less about the things that we care about. They don't speak our language, right? It's not that important to them. You can give them infinite lists of vulnerabilities. That's not actionable in their world. They can't change behavior based upon that. But this is the world that we live in as practitioners. You know, what is vulnerable in the technical issues and configuration things and basic flaws and conceptual problems and algorithms and so forth? This is the world that we live in. And it occurred to me, just for a quick historical story. Now, this story is about 6, 7, close to 8 years old now. I'm telling the story kind of more simply than it happened, and a little bit more linearly than it happened, okay? But you got to have a good story. And as I say, it's good enough for government work, so I'm going to tell the story this way because I'm telling the story. But it's a really exciting kind of change of perspective for the government. And I didn't think of this all ahead of time. This kind of evolved as we went along. What happened is in about late 99 or so, my group at NSA, I had a group called the System and Network Attack Center at NSA. Good guys, I promise you. And one of our businesses was blue team testing. That is going out to help system administrators in the Defense Department and doing kind of the usual stuff, right? Scanning for vulnerabilities, configuration analysis of the components that are out there and so forth, and give recommendations, that sort of thing. And we had produced a very successful, what we call a security guide for Windows NT as a byproduct of that. It wasn't a specialty product. It wasn't like a separate group of people doing it. It was just a byproduct. And we did it as much to train our own people as we did for anything else. And it became kind of a giveaway, something we could give to customers when we left. Hey, these are the kind of criteria we test against. And this is really nitty-gritty, you know, registry-level kind of advice that we would give out. And it became something we could give to people when we didn't have time to go visit them. We didn't have the resources to visit everybody that wanted us to come visit. And but it became very successful. And a number of folks kind of grabbed it, used it, adopted it maybe, successful to the point where DISA, the Defense Information Systems Agency, adopted it as kind of the official DoD standard. Now, DoD standard does not mean what you might think it means. It doesn't mean if it's a DoD standard, everyone at DoD is using it. It's a lot more complicated than that. But it was very successful. And around that time, then, Windows 2000 started to emerge as an issue for the Defense Department. Okay, when should we roll over? How should we operate it? And so forth. And my team, who had worked on the Windows NT, you know, these were the blue team folks. This wasn't some big, gigantic room full of folks whose specialty was thinking about configurations and writing guides. They showed up and said, Tony, we've looked at this Windows 2000 thing, and it's a lot bigger than the NT, and we're not sure we can do this. What are we going to do? You know, we don't have any more people, and we don't have any more resources. What do we do? I said, okay. And we thought about it for a few seconds, literally, and said, let's go call everybody else in the U.S. government that has a similar Windows NT security guide and see if they want to work together. And that's kind of what the state of the art was in the late 90s, early 2000s, right? We did a quick count. There were something like mid-teens unique Windows NT security guides floating around sponsored by some government agency somewhere. We did, you know, that's the best count that we could come up with. And we literally tried to get a human being's name and call down the list and say, hey, you know, you worked on NT, what are you going to do about 2000? Do you want to work together? And here's an inside secret about the sad life of government bureaucracies, right? Literally, in an afternoon, that list evaporated from 14 down to 2 or 3. So what had happened? People had been reorganized, lost the mission and funding, you know, whatever, that just kind of evaporated. Some of them had adopted our guide or, you know, were getting their advice from somebody else. So this big market of unique products had kind of dissipated. So at the end of the day, it was us, our friends at DISA, and I think Navy Space War had a little bit of help that they would offer. And another belief was kind of building in my mind at that time that said, now why is the Defense Department's problem any different than the rest of the government's problem? And why is that any different than the rest of the community's problem? And I couldn't come up with a reason why they were different. So I started calling other people that were kind of in the security advice business, like the SANS Institute. I'm sure many of you have taken classes from them. And then there was a little nonprofit starting up called the Center for Internet Security. And I said, so what are you guys going to do about Windows 2000? And I don't know, what are you going to do? And then it all came down to, well, how do we do something together? So that started an informal movement of folks, practitioners, to get together and develop security guidance up front. And we call this the Consensus Guide for Windows 2000. I wrote an open press article that's floating around on the web at various places. If you're interested, there's a link I could tell you about. And what I wanted to explain was from NSA's perspective, why were we doing this? You know, both as a resource thing and a community thing. But that became the start of a partnership that's lasted through these years of practitioners working together. Right, so my goal was to bring the advice givers together. Why should our customers have to decide, do I trust the NIST guys more than the NSA guys, more than the DISA guys or the CIS folks? It didn't make any sense to me. Why don't we work together up front and we can come up with maybe something even better than any one of us would have on our own, and by the way, we could share labor. Right? So that made a lot of sense to me. So practitioners, this has become the model now, and you may have seen some of the press about us working with Microsoft up front on the shipped security configuration for Vista. I'll mention that in just a bit. So rethinking the way we did this up front. So big change for a government bureaucracy, especially a really secretive place like ours. In parallel, some of you may have noticed that we started a campaign to release all this to the public. Okay, so that I got permission to post on the NSA public web server the security guides. And this was major culture shock within NSA, just take my word for it. But really was quite a dramatic change in the way we thought about this problem. And again, for me and my team, it was based on this belief that we really couldn't see what our baseline security problem, why was it different than everybody else's problem? And by the way, since everyone's connected to everybody, right, there is no standalone Defense Department to be protected anymore. We're hopelessly interlocked with our business suppliers and our partners and, you know, all these communication systems and weather data from public sources and all kinds of stuff. So our security now depends on everybody's security, right? So you don't get better in something as vast as a DoD unless everybody gets better. I mean, that's what I believe, and that's the way we've acted, right? So that says you have to push outside your borders and think about how do we solve this as a national level problem. Okay, so lots of folks started banding together. Lots of folks started to adopt this stuff. It became kind of a thing, you know. We'll take our checklists from, I think NIST calls them checklists, CIS calls them benchmarks, we call them security guides. And by the way, when I say consensus, you know, no one's in charge, right? Everyone kind of works together. It's a classic herding cats kind of exercise. Every once in a while, the cats wander off this way or that way. You all know we're in a business filled with really, really bright, really, really opinionated people who will fall on their sword for the last registry setting and the last recommendation. So keeping everyone kind of heading in the same direction when no one's clearly in charge and no one's paying for it all is a great challenge. But it's a really satisfying challenge. And it's actually, I believe, more powerful than trying to put a government bureaucracy in charge, because people are there because they want to be there and they want to bring their content and they want to get the recognition of their peers and so forth. But believe me, it is herding cats. So people started to adopt this. In an interesting twist, every one of us, you know, NSA, NIST, DISA, everybody has their own constituency that came to the table. And there came to be this sort of, bringing together of opinion and bringing together of operational usage. And another thing started to happen, that the buyers started to take notice of this. Well, wait a minute. Our folks want to operate our clients and servers this way. Why don't we buy it that way? Why don't we tell the vendor that we want it pre-configured, operated this way from scratch? You know, for something like Defense Department, do we really expect that the way to deal with network security is to ship wide-open systems to everybody in the DoD, ask every poor person under-trained, under-loved, under-resourced person in the DoD to configure a system from scratch to be secure? That's clearly a losing strategy, right? So why bother with that? We are not going to train everybody in the DoD to be a security wizard, right? The knowledge that folks like you have is pretty precious stuff, and it's not something that comes for free, so you're not going to get it for free. And so you've got to think of this, how do I make it easier for those frontline operators of the IT? Because our security depends upon them. So Air Force has really led the way for the U.S. government in this, and we've worked very closely with the Air Force on their baseline configuration. This has gotten a lot of press in the last 2 years or so, if you follow this sort of thing. But basically, Air Force, in order to simplify their network management problem primarily, decide to standardize on a very small number of desktop loads, you know, the OS plus the applications, and then servers. And the idea is, we've got to make this simple, we've got to be able to manage this, we've got to be able to automate it. So we work with them very closely on sort of defining what constitutes a usable, prudent security baseline. That has become a really important thing, and you know, we work with them very closely to track breakage. That has become the model now for the entire U.S. government by mandate from the Office of Management and Budget. That is, every government agency is expected now to follow this basic model, right? Tighten up your systems, define a baseline configuration, work with the security community to define what that means, tell the vendor this is what we're gonna buy from you. We are now reversing the security problem. Why do things break? Well, every time you tighten security, applications break. Well, why do they break? Well, because we never told anybody what our runtime environment would look like in terms of security. So vendors write in whatever manner, use whatever ports, whatever services are convenient for them. Okay. But now, as you can define what a DoD system looks like, you can turn to your software developers and your suppliers and say, before you sell to me, you need to certify that it will run in this environment. And Microsoft is a participant by creating virtual images by which vendors can test, and we can certify their products will run in this environment, right? So it's reversing the security equation. So it's a tremendously powerful idea that is now becoming the model for the entire U.S. government. And I'm sure that will spin off if you're a supplier to the government. The government is worrying more and more about, hey, if you're a supplier to me, I expect the same level of network security in your network when you're handling my data and my resources as I do for my own. So prove it to me, right? Show me that you are operating by the same technical policy that I am. So, of course, then the vendors have to be involved in this, you know, the big OS vendors and everybody else, because, frankly, if this is the way the buyers want it, then they will deliver it. But, you know, what they don't want is some gold-plated standard that breaks things and causes them lots of expense to answer the phones and troubleshoot and so forth, right? So they say, well, I might as well work with the security geeks up front so that we'd make the right kind of trade-offs in operational capability vice security. And so that has led to close working partnerships with the major OS vendors on sort of what constitutes a baseline security configuration. And then a whole new market has popped up in the last several years, partly through personal lobbying and partly through just people seeing this opportunity for themselves. Well, wait a minute. If these enterprises want to run their clients the NIST way or the CIS way or whatever, well, I'm going to tweak the tools I've already sell into the market to measure and report on compliance against those benchmarks, right? So it has become an emerging market in a pretty big way now. So you can say, well, I want to run my clients this way, their measurement tools from any of the major IT security tool vendors, and they operate, you know, in kind of this fashion. And then what happened, even better, was folks who are authorities, people who have sort of regulatory or oversight things, and all of us are governed by something in our lives, you know, FISMA, HIPAA, Sarbanes-Oxley, and all these large-scale, well-meaning, you know, handle data responsibly kind of things that are happening today. This is where a lot of the money is going that should be spent on security. And they all want good security, but they don't really define it very well. So what's happened with us, all this sort of security guidance and stuff that I talked about, NIST has really leaped on this and said, hey, you need to operate your IT this way, and that will take you down the right automation path for FISMA compliance, specifically for the U.S. government. So a very powerful idea that takes away a lot of this sort of Wild West, well, how do I comply? Well, I have to write a lot of paper to convince somebody that I complied with FISMA. That's kind of how the world works today. And when you see, you know, government agency so-and-so, including us, gets a D or an F on the report card, that's what they're reporting on, is the quality of the paper that's being generated to prove they did the right thing. But it doesn't link very well to the technical, what did they actually do, right? So that's what's happening now, is NIST in particular is leading a group to make that linkage and to clarify that so that everybody individually across, or every agency individually across the U.S. government doesn't have to make that case for themselves, which is just a tremendous waste of resources. Okay, so I kind of walked through this quickly. This is a multi-year story that really started from a pretty modest beginnings, right? Thinking about testing systems, what would my recommendations be? Let's go find the people that kind of work in the same sphere with us, the practitioners, people that start to adopt it. You know, and the real breakthrough was creating guidance in actionable form. So I mentioned earlier about speaking other people's language is the only way to change things, right? So the security people want to say, well, we ran all these scans, we found thousands of vulnerabilities, and this is really cool, and we give it to the operator, and they go, what am I going to do with this? You know, it doesn't tie into my trouble ticketing system. How should I configure my systems and set up file permissions and registry settings to stop these vulnerabilities? See, that's the language they speak. They speak the language of system administration. So the vulnerability finders up front, right, the blue teamers, that kind of stuff, until they create something in the language of system administration, there's nothing actionable to work with. Well, the buyers, they don't even speak that language, right? They don't speak, you know, configurations and file permissions. They speak, what do I put in the request for proposal or in the specification? What should I demand of the vendor so I get better security up front? So we help create the language that goes into the buyer's hands to make this much more powerful for the vendor to operate with, right? And then when you work with the vendors, you've got to sit down with them and look at the trade-offs in how things break, you know, because they are much more aware of their very broad customer base and the complaints they get over the phone and, you know, the things their field engineers have to deal with. So they say, hey, you government geeks think this is the most important thing in security, but as soon as we tighten this, you know, 5,000 applications break over here. That's their language that they want to operate in. And they pay attention when the buyers demand. And then authority folks, you know, bless their hearts, they're the least technical of all. They're just looking for good things to happen at very large scale. And they write laws or directives or policies, and that's the world that they live in. So you have to give them some content in their form so that they can make changes across scale, right? So the way to achieve success at the national level is to think about this. This is not purely a technical exercise or an uber geek exercise. This is about translation, helping people all across all the stakeholders in this business think about this problem, speak in their language, give them something to work with. And they all want to do the right thing. That's really important. They all want better security, but they just don't know how to ask for it until you help them. And it's communities like this, right? We that speak the kind of language of geekdom that really have to help create that, because it really starts from the analysis and the understanding of the technology, or we just never get there. What's happened behind the scenes in parallel with that story over several years is the development of what I call the plumbing of vulnerability, if you'll pardon me. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, it all comes down to content, right? What is the content of the world that we live in of vulnerabilities? Well, it's knowing about new flaws in pieces of software, IT vulnerabilities. It's security guidance. That's unique content created by people. Security guides, benchmarks, whatever you call them. Things like red and blue team reports. We go out and test the system and we found all these problems. That's unique content. Tests of individual products, tracking of security incidents, you know, bad guy so-and-so has done this to this IP in the Defense Department, et cetera, et cetera. This is the unique content of vulnerability in my world. The problem is this content is often generated independently by different people speaking a different language, even within the technical community. And so the challenge is, you know, we don't want to do red teaming for red teaming's sake, right? What's the reason for testing products or doing operational tests? It's so we can fix these problems and operate our IT more securely or get it more securely from the vendor to start with. So you need a way to move this content from place to place, and that's what I call the plumbing. So I'm sure some of you are familiar with some of these terms here. These are standards that are out in the public that we have either developed at NSA or sponsored at places like MITRE or done jointly with other folks like NIST. Okay, so it's not all uniquely from us. But CVE is the standard naming scheme for vulnerabilities out in the public. It's kind of the universal language of how we refer uniquely to flaws in IT. OVAL is a standard test language. CCE, Common Configuration Enumeration, CPE, these are two kind of brand new things, Common Platform Enumeration, unique ways to refer to specific versions of pieces of software running out in the environment and so forth. These are standards that were developed mostly independently that are coming together now to constitute what I call the plumbing of vulnerability. That is the ability to move information from place to place in a way that poor human beings don't have to do all the moving or the integrating or the analysis. And so what we've done is reframe a lot of the work that we do so that our output speaks these standard languages. I'll mention one in particular, XCCDF. I hope I get this right. Extensible Common Checklist Descriptive Format, I think, from NSA. It's now in a NIST standards program. You can look it up on the web, and I'll give you a link to it later. But it will become the new universal language of security guidance. Right? For us in the old days, security guidance was literally narrative. we recommend you set registry setting so-and-so to, you know, key to so-and-so, right? That's the way it worked. And then we'd produce plugins for specialty tools. What's the new universal language of guidance? Same as everything else, an open standard XML. XCCDF will become, by consensus among all the advice givers, the new universal expression of security guidance. So that's machine processable, right? So it allows you to move kind of recommendations from, you know, the minds of the analysts out to the tools that measure and report and so forth. So this is a really important activity. Now, not all these standards are fully mature. They're still underway. You have plenty of opportunities if you want to help turn these into the right kinds of things. But it's maturing very rapidly, and there's some major activity around this, both with us and with NIST. There's a major workshop in mid to late September that you're welcome to be a part of if you like this kind of stuff. And the little dots on the bottom, there's plenty more standards. And the fixtures, if you'll pardon me straining the metaphor just a little bit longer. So to move the content via the plumbing to something useful, right? So multiple tools to measure and report. And, you know, I live in a world that's very complex. You know, the Army does not have one vulnerability tool. It's got many tools because it's got networks that are worldwide, fixed plant. It's got networks that's running out of air-conditioned tents in really nasty locations and everything in between. No tool, single tool, runs that. No single vulnerability scanner can deal with that. You inherently live in an environment of very great complexity and lots of mixing and matching. You have to be able to bring information together across multiple tools to drive multiple remediations. And you cannot count on poor human beings to make that integration happen. Right? You can do it a little bit if you buy every tool from a single vendor, you know, because vendors are buying each other up vertically faster than we can count now. But the real way to deal with this is through an open standards kind of way. So we're very strong on that. So integrating the reports. Why are red team reports separate from blue team reports when they, in fact, give really complementary information? But again, the humans can't wade through enough narrative and written pages to correlate this because red teamers talk about password things differently than blue teamers do. So you need to, again, work the plumbing issues, record the data differently up front. That's a really important part of this. And then all these other things, policy compliance to let us link. So I want to give you a hint. Behind the scenes, there's actually a lot of technical activity. This is not just about guidance and good advice, but in fact, it's a really massive activity to build plumbing, that is to move data around in a mostly automated fashion. This gets bundled together in an umbrella program that's honed at NIST, jointly sponsored by us, DISA, a little bit by DHS and NIST, called the Security Content Automation Program, which encompasses all those standards into kind of a nice, neat bundle, links it to FISMA compliance. Again, not everything is mature in this, but it's looking really, really, really promising, and the interest from vendors and the acceptance with them is very high. So I think this is an opportunity to make massive progress for the entire nation in this. Urge you to take a look at it. Again, there's some events coming up. If you like this kind of stuff, you have an opportunity to get involved in that. Real quickly, I'll run through another quick anecdote here that, again, gives you my perspective. It's a parallel and related story. Each of these little cylinders on the bottom is a job among many others that my group does. So red team testing, blue team testing. OPSEC is operations security. You know, what do we give away for free to the bad guys through websites and that kind of stuff. CompSec monitoring is the by permission. We have a group. It's a very military thing primarily. Monitoring plain text communications primarily as to protect the forces in the Middle East. What are we giving away for free to bad guys? You know, about when the SEALs go in and where the convoy is going to go and stuff like that. Can we find that, turn it around so we can change our plans so that the bad guys don't take advantage of that? Technical security is about physical spaces and signals and so forth, going out to sweep and look for things. The reason I draw them in these little boxes here, each of these jobs evolve from a different management structure at a different time, different funding lines, different skills and so forth, right? They started independently. And they optimized independently. And when you're operating jobs like this, then your concern is about how efficient can I be? Can I do 20% more jobs next year than I did this year? Are all my people trained and so forth? And this becomes the manner that you operate, right? And in the polite to politically correct terms, these are developed in a stovepipe, is the way I might have said it before. Well, they're not really stovepipes. Now we call them, to be politically correct, cylinders of excellence. Okay, so each of these is a really important cylinder of excellence. In fact, some of them were very highly polished cylinders of excellence so that nothing could ever leak from them. That's the way these things evolved, and the world is different now. So a few years ago, I started to refocus all these folks that work for me in particular to say, you know, remember that practitioner word I used? we're not the only red team in the DOD, or the only blue team, or the only tech hackers. Go find the community of people that are like you. Right? Go find the rest of the community. In most cases, all modesty implied, NSA will usually have the biggest and baddest team. I mean, that's just the fact of where we happen to sit. But, you know, when you're the biggest and baddest in a community, then your responsibility is to go help others. Okay? So go find the others. Let's start acting like a community. What does a community do? Well, they get together. They share lessons learned. They swap tools, right? They come up with ways to record the data so that it can be correlated. They host events. They train people. They certify organizations. And so now we do all those things across every one of those communities or within every one of those communities, some formalized for the DOD, some less formal. Okay. So that became a big theme for us maybe 6-7 years ago, and I think it's been a very successful way to think of this. But it's still not really good. Okay, what I decided several years ago was that, you know, in something like the DOD, you're not going to test your way to security one network at a time. Right? It's just too big. That's not why we're doing this. So why do we do red team and blue team? So I said, our new business model is sampling. Yes, we want to help the customer that asked us to sample their network, right, to test their network. But the real value, the long-term win for the DOD, is sampling. That is, what can I learn about this that will help me solve this problem at scale? All right, so remember, seventh grade science, what's the purpose of sampling? It's so we can draw conclusions about the underlying population. So that became our model. Let's learn from not only red, but blue in all these jobs. What conclusions can we draw about the real problem? What's most common? What's the root cause? Where's the best place in the life cycle to solve this problem? That really became the mantra. Okay, this business is about sampling the environment, then deciding where among those stakeholders is the optimal place to solve this problem. So you see how this parallels as we put this together? And then we have a buzz phrase for this called integrated analysis and reporting. That is, you know, if I learn it in the blue team kind of world, I need to know it for the red team kind of world. Right? It's interesting. When the red teamers do things, by the way, people don't realize, you know, they're very quiet and stealthy and narrow. They don't really get to see most of the network because they don't look around because it's too noisy. Right? So they demonstrate exploitation scenarios. So it's interesting to me that a red team succeeds, but until you match it up with like a blue team view, what's behind the firewall and how the system's configured and what critical things are dependent upon that piece of IT, you don't really have a very good picture as to what's going on. And in CompSec monitoring, you get to see, we just gave away really important information that's a critical part of red team scenarios that bad guys could be exploiting, right? So integrating this information across multiple sources is a really important thing. But you can't do it the way we were collecting the data before, right? Because how would you do it? You'd put your best human beings in a room with literally thousands of pages of narrative trying to sort that out. It's impossible. So you want technology to do the grunt work. So you need the same plumbing that I talked about before, right? Let's record our data from red team and sensors and blue teamers up front differently, and then we can bring it together. Let the technology do the grunt work of the 60-80%, you know, just the simple stuff. Let's turn the human beings loose on analysis, because that's really where we want them. So that became our whole different way of thinking about this problem. So I want to share this story really briefly with you, because it's in parallel, and it shows you kind of the way we've been thought about this, the way we've reached out to a much broader community of folks beyond us, in a sort of different than the guidance stuff. Okay, so I'm an old guy in computer security. I've never had another job. Some people will say I've never had a real job. But I've learned a lot of things, so let me just show you a couple things to wrap up. To gain assurance in this business, these are kind of my lessons learned from decades of this and thinking about this as a government kind of guy, that you have to think about this problem at scale if we're ever going to solve it at scale nationally. So these are the way I think about it. You've got to organize the content generators. Okay? Bring them together to think about this problem together, the people that create new intellectual property that tells us some kind of insight, lets us draw new conclusions. You have to bring them together. To bring them together, you have to go out and be among them. Okay, and that's why I'm out at places like this. You have to standardize the raw data. Otherwise, we're just going to wade through pages of narrative hoping that, you know, brilliance leaps out of there for us. It's not going to happen. So we got to think really hard about standardizing the raw data so that we can bring it together. And we have to think about storing that data in a way, by the way, you know, I know how to deal with the reds and the blues and all these kind of friends, but the challenge is, people that need this data are often not people I know or ever met before. So we have to record the data that's discoverable by them in their context, right? That's the new model of information management today. You have to translate into something useful upstream. So we speak a certain language, as I described, but the people who are going to solve this problem at different places in the life cycle speak an entirely different language. So our responsibility is to help translate what we know into something else, preferably in someone else's language. And then the real key has been to link to other business areas. That is, again, we live and breathe this sort of stuff, but other people are just trying to manage their networks better. okay, or they're trying to arrange for compliance so that data is well protected. So you have to link what you know to these things, or we'll never make great change. Because, by the way, things like compliance, that's where the money goes, right? You can show up with a list of 1,000 vulnerabilities, and people just scratch their heads, and they say, they give it to the poor sysadmin and say, fix it. That doesn't cut it anymore, okay? The money goes for FSBA and Sarbanes-Oxley and HIPAA and so forth. So you've got to help people do the right thing there technically so that we're not overwhelming the poor frontline defenders. Okay, and then last thought about the role of the government and working with the private sector. A couple of things for me. Again, we're the government. We're here to help you. Nobody cares. Okay, that's a different world. My experience has been, bring content to the table. So that's why we released, our security guidance to the public. If you go there, I promise you, you'll see stuff that you won't believe came from NSA. Bring content. People know you're serious. They'll pick at it. They'll find flaws. They'll come up with improvements. What are you going to do? You're going to thank them, right? You're going to thank them and improve it. That's the way things work today. Put your content on the table. Let people chew on it, and it'll get better. That's really not the way government agencies are used to operating, by the way. So that makes a lot of people in my world nervous, but that's what we really got to do. And bring good people. Okay, that's why my folks are out at places like this. I'm sure you'll spot some of them. When you meet some of my folks, you'll realize these are your friends, these are your peers, they have similar technical skills, they want to do good things, they're trying to protect the nation, they love technology, they live and breathe this stuff. And again, they're not bureaucrats here to organize you, they're folks that are here as part of the community, where you step out and become part of you guys. If you're going to work across government, the private sector, you got to equip and organize the stakeholders. And I gave that whole argument about the different classes of them, especially the buyers. Their money talks. And then abstract the interfaces. I know it's kind of geeky, but it's how do things talk to each other? How do blue team reports get used to change system behavior? Right? How do I move information from places? How does a vulnerability scanner talk to a patch manager? Places like that, these interfaces, are places for the government to take a hard look and say, should that be open? Should that be a standard? Should that be something that's abstracted out of vendor bilateral agreements into an open standard? That's where I'm always looking for opportunities to open the business up to other folks. Okay? You may have seen us in the news. We are, as far as NSA technical centers go, we are head and shoulders the most publicly known, the Vulnerability Analysis and Operations Group. And so I spend a lot of time talking to folks, there aren't too many folks like you, but to audiences about our work, looking for new friends, partners, and telling you that we're okay, we're bringing our content to the table, we're doing our share, and then some. And you can track all this. A lot of this broke. This is just places we've been mentioned in the last 6 months or so, 6-7 months. A lot of this was triggered by Microsoft's public announcement that they worked with us on the shipped configuration for Vista, just to let you know. And I was interviewed in Washington Post sometime during the winter. Lots of stories followed from that, and you can go look this stuff up if you're interested. We also received 2 unsolicited awards from national magazines, SC Magazine and Government Computer News. So we are really out there in the community. You don't come to NSA because you love public recognition, believe me. But it's really been a change of heart for us. It really has dramatically sort of changed the perspective, but it's also really gratifying to my workforce, right? Because they want to be a part of a community like this and work with folks like you because we want to solve this problem. Last thing, to learn more, these are some links where you can track some stuff down. NSA Security Guidance, again, the Security Content Automation Program, there's lots of stuff there at NIST about these standards and about other things that are going on. The Center for Internet Security, you can find reposted an article that I wrote in the early 2000s about this. It's a little dated now, but it tells you why NSA moved out into a much more public sphere. And with that, I want to thank you. Before I get the hook, this is the only conference where I have to gulp before I hit the on button on my laptop. And then number two, where there's actually a bouncer to kick me out of here when the time is up. So, but I want to again thank you for spending your morning here with me. I know your time is really valuable, and it's great to come talk about our work here. So thank you all very much.